Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library, yeah, standing there behind the counter, willing to...
Kia ora, everyone. Well, here we are in the month of May. A full-on month in Auckland. We still have the Comedy Fest on. We have New Zealand Music Month, where lots of libraries are hosting artists and events in celebration of New Zealand music. And most importantly, Karen... In the books world, we have the Auckland Writers Festival, 15th to 20th of May. So it's an annual calendar event, isn't it? Not just for Aucklanders, but so many from all around the country make it an annual must-do, must-come-to event. So it started, I was doing some research because I haven't been going to...
Because I am a librarian.
Because I am a librarian as well. So it started live. In 1999, held at the Hyatt Hotel, for those who don't aren't from Auckland, the Hyatt Hotel in Auckland, sorry. And so it will be its 20th anniversary next year too, I was thinking, so that'll be a big one. But the first festival started with an attendance of 5,200 people, they'd say, 70 local and local and international guests, and 40 events for that first one. So here we are in 2018. I mean, last year they had over 60,000 people in attendance, and over 200 international and local writers, illustrators, journalists, you know, everyone from the book world, so, or the literary world. So, yes, an amazing story, really, isn't it? About
A story in its own right.
Yes.
The place where we hear stories is also a story in its own right. Also, it'd become a lot longer. I'm not sure. I didn't go to the first festivals. I wasn't even in New Zealand. But I believe when I started, it was two or three days. The very first one I went to was at the Hyatt, and it was Peter. I went to one event. I was just a humble library assistant. I was allowed time off to go see one event, and I went to see Peter Wells interview Jonathan Franzen, great American writer of the great American novel, as he liked to present himself, not exactly in those words. It was a auspicious beginning. I thought it was a really good chance to actually make up my mind about what I thought about this novelist whose book had enchanted me and then towards the end let me down and then picked up again. And seeing the person really does give it that extra dimension. I was not won over by Jonathan Franzen, just put it out there. But that's the great thing about festivals. You know?
Well, over the course of our shows, Karen, you have mentioned, and most of them, a writer you've met or interviewed at the various festivals that you have attended. And I've always been really impressed. Wow, you know, she's had so many great experiences through the festival. So what I was going to ask you is, what would you say, is there one memorable experience or amongst them all that from those you've attended?
I'd be hard put to say just one. I think every year you come away with at least every year of two or three standouts. Last year, I think my standouts were Roxane Gay, absolutely, and Teju Cole was another two figures that I was really interested in already following. And then there's always the surprises that come along. I remember seeing Alan Cumming. It was a total surprise to me. Absolutely fantastic evening. And another was Sandy Toksvig. I always get her name wrong, but because I didn't know who she was, and I went to see her, and she was absolutely really uplifting. Oh, hate the word uplifting, but enlivening of the spirit evening, very warm and out there. I think one of my favorite events ever was a couple of years ago when Susie Orbach and Jeanette Winterson were both at the festival presenting their own events, but they were so popular and the events got sold out so quickly that the festival arranged for an extra pop-up event where they came on together. It was done at 9:30 at night after everything else had finished in a small room upstairs. I remember it had a bar, and don't ask me to name which room it was, but it had its own bar, so we all had glasses of wine, and there were bean chairs in the front. Is that what they call it? Bean bags.
Bean bags. Chairs.
chairs.
Yeah.
Beanbag chairs in the front.
Yeah.
And it was one of those lovely events because it had, you know, when you think of all the reasons why people go to festivals, one of them, of course, is the unexpected glimpses that you might get of somebody that you feel you've only had the official version up till then, and you're going to get the personal, up close and personal.
They used to call it unplugged, didn't they?
Unplugged. And that was a great event where they started out, so they, you know, they come out and they sat down on this little couch and they said, so Jeanette Winterson started out right away, so who here thinks they're creative? And of course all the hands go up. Nothing about a Writers Festival audience, including myself. Who here thinks they're crazy? And just about as many hands go up, maybe one or two. And she says, well, this is what we're going to talk about because, you know, I feel da-da-da, and she goes on, and then Susie Orbach, who was sitting calmly next to her on the couch, said, oh, that's very interesting. I'm actually not sure I agree. And then off started this conversation between the two of them with sort of opposite points of view on some of the aspects of the discussion about creativity. It was about, the evening was about creativity. And then they sat up so people could see them better on the back of the couch instead of sitting on the couch. And that was just a really, really great, the maximum of the, you know, unexpected, being in their living room. It was like being in their room with them.
Yeah.
They loved us all, we love them. And another great aspect of the Writers Festival is, of course, that of the super writer, you know, the superhero writer. Is that what I'm trying to say? The superstar, excuse me. Superhero and superstar. The superstar writer. And one of those that I really enjoyed was seeing Haruki Murakami. And that was, I think, in 2015. And he was just amazing. He came out onto the stage in pink pants and running shoes. He's a big runner and wrote a whole book about it. And he was just the most amazing concentration of active molecules in a huge stage that I had ever seen. And he had this really intense way of talking in which every question that was put to him, he would answer in little short bursts while gesticulating with his hands. So he'd say the first sentence, and his hands would go into a position, and then there'd be a really long pause, total silence with his hands frozen in the air. And then another burst and another movement from his hands, and then again, totally frozen, another long wait. We're talking 30 seconds wait, and then another burst. And this was through every question that was asked through the entire session. And I've actually got here, because I looked it back up where I had written about it for the Books in the City blog at the Auckland Libraries. And I had, one of them was, for instance, here's one of my favorite examples of his way of talking. I am always looking for the bright side of things, but most of my fiction are not happy endings. I don't know. That's me being the long pause. You're wondering.
I thought we had a technical breakdown.
No, that was a long pause. So let's listen. I am always looking for the bright side of things, but most of my fiction are not happy endings. I don't know why.
Do not adjust your seat.
He is looking for something, finds it, but it's not what he expected. It was a really great example of both the superstar and the unexpected.
Yes, the poetic pause.
I'm not sure if it was poetic pause. I think he was just like gathering his... Of course, he is translating in his mind. Presumably, he's not speaking English in his own mind, so it could have been part of it, just getting the phrase out there. So, and then another really great event that I saw was, because I really like the argumentative ones, as I mentioned with Susie Orbach and Jeanette Winterson. We're not actually argumentative. In a teasing way, we're argumentative.
Yes.
But a more swords, rather more unsheathed, was a great event I saw in 2010. It was called What Good Are the Arts, which was inspired by a book that John Kerry had written called What Good Are the Arts. So John Kerry, one of my favorite people ever to have been at the festival, is a professor emeritus at Oxford of English or of literature, whatever it's called, and been, you know, so emeritus means 50 years teaching, and then there's also the Sunday Times book reviewer. A lot of people know him as that, and he was with Dennis Dutton, who's the editor, the creator and editor of Arts and Letters, an American, the big gray mop of hair, carefully blow-dried, and then Sarah Thornton, who had written a book about the art world. She'd gone undercover in the art world for 7 days and written a sort of an expose, which was not actually particularly expose of an expose, but very stylish. And anyway, so the question was, what good are the arts? So Sarah Thornton was convinced the arts were very good, and John Kerry was very skeptical, and he had this great quote about that he had read this thing by Maganita Lasky, and she had done a study on ecstatic states. And she discovered when she asked people what had caused you a transcendental experience, what was an example of a time when you had a transcendental experience? And he said, you know, childbirth was way up there, and sex, and even football, but art and literature were quite far down the list. And then the other one was, I really loved, he's very, very caustic, and wonderful way of speaking in a very dry tone. And he said, you know, I think if you get your kicks out of weeping over people in fiction, you're actually quite likely to ignore them in real life, which sometimes hard to disagree with.
Yes, especially in this world of social media.
Exactly. It's very true. This is exactly true. It's the people sitting up all night tweeting on social media. So, and then my favorite, I am just going to mention this last one, was a totally unexpected, because there's a final aspect to the literary festivals, which is the discovery. So this is the one where you go to hear someone you've never heard of, but there's something, a little blurb that appeals to you. And then you discover this amazing person and go and look for all their books and read them. And for me, that one of the most perfect examples of that was when I went to hear this 80-something-year-old French poet named Jacques Roubaud, who was a member of the historic Oulipo poetic group of poets and writers that was formed in Paris in the 1960s. It was this very cerebral association of writers who like to use word games. And the other great thing about the about Oulipo was, as Jacques Roubaud explained during the session, that you were not allowed, you could not be elected a member if you wanted to be a member. So, and it took them about 7 years to decide every time on who would be a member. So he said, often we would tell someone they had become a member and they had forgotten they had even been under consideration. He was just so funny.
Very playful, isn't it?
Exactly. So that was exactly about Oulipo. So Umberto Eco was a member, and Isola Calvino, and Georges Perec. So it was a really, you know, 1960s French, along with that same period we're talking, you know, the Nouvelle Vague. It was a nouvelle way of being playful about writing. And he read a wonderful poem. He's also a mathematician. And he read a wonderful poem all in binary that went 0101 0111 1010101. It was an entire sonnet written in binary. And my favorite moment, not my favorite moment, but a very good moment at that, was when somebody stood up during question time. That's another important thing about writers' festivals. During question time, and asked about the fact, oh, I'm just so shocked that Auckland Libraries doesn't have your books. And in fact, working in Auckland Libraries, I knew that we had tried to purchase the books in advance of the festival. But of course, Jacques Roubaud was so unknown that his books were mostly out of print or were not available through our suppliers. So they were on order, but they hadn't arrived in time for the festival. And so I was going to put up my hand, but in the meantime, Anne French was also the chair of the session, was also casting about for a way to sidestep this, not really knowing what to do. And Jacques Roubaud leaned forward and held up a finger and said very politely, "May I comment? I am not surprised. I do not have a lot of readers. I have 100 readers worldwide." That was the best. So, yeah.
That was cool.
That was my favorite.
Thank you so much, because as much as we'd all love to attend the Writers' Festival every year or as many sessions as possible, we just can't always get there. So many events are sold out.
Yeah.
And so
they do have podcasts of the, they are all videoed now as compared to the first times. It's the first festivals. They are videoed and then are made or made available as podcasts. So, like our program.
Yeah.
Which is, well, not videoed, but taped.
Yeah. So, oh, good. That's really interesting to know. And it would be really handy for lots of listeners to know. And, I'm sure.
Yeah, and now, I wanted to ask you, so what were your, those were my favorites of the past. Going into the future, what picks, what have you got on?
Well,
on
I
the menu
actually had
your...
one more question to ask you, because I did find your articles on the Writers' Festivals on the Auckland Libraries blog. And in one of them, you mentioned, you were saying, writing that the lead question to the authors was, seemed to be the same for every writer, which was, how did you become a writer?
Yes.
So So I guess, you know, if that's fine for all those who are inspiring to be a writer, they'd probably really be really interested in that question, but I'm not. So, and I don't know about you. So I was wondering what this year's question might be at the festival. And then I was thinking, what would the question we put? What would if we were interviewing the authors, what lead question would we put to them, Karen? I was wondering.
Well, my favorite question to ask writers is always they're usually presenting a book. They're usually on a tour because they've just recently written a book. And I always like to ask what was the most surprising thing that happened to them in the course of writing the book, because that is a part of writing that you think you know where you're going when you start out, but then as it goes along, it takes on a life of its own and it can take you to unexpected places. The most unexpected question I ever heard asked at the festival is when somebody from the audience, the Q&A part, which is always some people hate it, some people love it, is when somebody asked Haruki Murakami what his favorite food was, and it turned out to be tofu and donuts, not necessarily together.
Oh, good.
But anyway, so, and what are your picks coming up?
Well, I'm a traveller. I always like to know what motivates someone to visit a place, you know, even if it's a local outing. So I would like to ask, you know, I'd welcome the famous author to Auckland, and then politely sort of ask them, you know, what made them accept the invitation to the Auckland Writers' Festival? You know, what brought them here, hear the story of about their journey to the festival, about to Auckland, and I'd find that really interesting as well. I mean, there's so many festivals, especially for the international authors, there's so many festivals on the world stage. So here we are in Auckland. What brought them here? Especially your poet, Jacques Roubaud, who must have been in his 80s, I think.
Yes, he was.
When
yes.
he came here. So, an interesting story there as to what brought him to New Zealand.
Who are you going to be asking? Are you going to be the brave one to put up your hand and ask a question? In which session have you chosen?
Well, I'm not sure if I'll be bravely putting up my hand to ask a question, but I was looking at the program, and there's just so many. I mean, we just want to go to all the sessions, don't we? But we can't. So I came across A.C. Grayling, or Anthony Grayling, but known as A.C. Grayling, a philosopher and humanist, and was thinking, oh, he'd be really cool to hear, and I have read half of one of his books. He's actually written 30 books on philosophy, so I do intend to get through more than just half. He's an author, he's a newspaper columnist, he's the vice president of the Humanist Society, an activist, he's against Britain leaving the EU, and he's actually the professor of philosophy and the founder of the new College of Humanities in London. So a very busy man. He says he's busy because tragically his sister was murdered in Africa when he was 19. And this is just a terrible story, but amazing, I guess. And so when his family went to visit, identify his sister's body, his mother, who was already quite ill, actually had a heart attack and died. So they had the two deaths in the family at the same time. And he says that this is what spurred him to become such a busy workaholic, because that's why he spent the rest of his life working full stop,
fully working non-stop.
Yes. So that's why I won't be asking questions at the Q&A session.
Right.
I won't get the wrong word out.
People have them written down, you know, they take out a little piece of paper from their pocket.
Ah, right. And so
the next one there looks
and
very
my own our own Alison Jones, professor at Auckland University's Faculty of Education and Social Work. So she is one of the authors of the book A Traveller in Two Worlds, by Alison Jones and Kunika Jenkins. And so this is a great book, which I've read when it first came out, but I'll just quickly read the blurb from the cover rather than try and tell you what it's all about. In the early 1870s, In early 1870, Tuai, a young Ngāri Raumati chief from the Bay of Islands, set off for England. He was one of a number of Māori who, after encountering encountering European explorers, traders and missionaries in New Zealand, seized opportunities to travel beyond their familiar shores to Australia, England and Europe in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. They sought new knowledge, useful goods and technologies and a mutual beneficial relationship with the people they knew as Pākehā. So on his epic journey to why I would visit exotic foreign ports, mixed with teeming crowds and huge in the huge metropolis of London and witness the marvels of the industrialisation at Ironbridge Gorge in Shropshire. So that's an amazing story.
That sounds really like a wonderful event.
It was. I really enjoyed it. And I just want to mention that, here I go, page 87 is a couple of drawings that Tuai made when he was in London. I think he was recovering from an illness that nearly killed him. And so these two pen drawings, pen and ink drawings, are now in the Sir George Grey Special Collections at Auckland Libraries. I don't know, maybe he was thinking, I'm going to die and we're not going to make it home. So he's done these two drawings and they eventually did end up back in New Zealand. So I'll just read the blurb about one of them. These two elaborate waka drawn by Tuai contain striking figures with their staring eyes, flowing hair and head feathers. They could be ancestral spirits brought closer to Tuai as he struggled with a dangerous illness. Perhaps he hoped the waka would take him home if he were to die in England. So he did not die in England. He did come back to New Zealand eventually. And so I recommend that read to anyone. And I'd love to catch up with Alison Jones at the Writers' Festival. Having read her first book at school, I've Got a Chance, which was based on some research that she did in the 1980s. On the New Zealand education system and the education of Pacific Island children, which is still a very important topic in this day and age. So, yes, I would love to meet her and interview her one day. So, Karen,
I've got a couple up my sleeve as well, my starring events that I want to go to. So I've got, my first one is Susie Boyd, who wrote one of my cult books, which is My Judy Garland Life. She's the daughter of Lucian Freud, the very famous artist who is the grandson of Sigmund Freud, and who had possibly 40 children, it's been reported, but at least definitely 14 from six different women.
Wow.
By all accounts. Yes, it is. By
14
all accounts,
to 40.
A magnetic and charismatic man has been described.
We lost a few children along the way, did we?
Possibly. He possibly might have. He did not live with her and her mother. Her mother had four children with him, or three or four, while another woman was just about contemporaneously, while another woman was also having three or four children with him.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who sometimes promised her things and didn't come through. And as a lonely child, she fell in love with Judy Garland. It started a lifelong obsession. She went to see her first movie ever, The Wizard of Oz. And it started this lifelong obsession, as I was saying. And I think that, you know, I really identify with this, actually. My father was a huge fan of Judy Garland. He himself had had some lonely aspects to his childhood. And the Judy Garland Life, My Judy Garland Life, is actually not just a book. It's got a lot about Judy Garland, but in more in general, it's a book about fandom, very contemporary, although it's quite old. It's you know, quite contemporary in terms of talking about celebrity obsession. I personally read it more for the obsession in general. I'm not necessarily obsessed with celebrities, but I'm definitely an obsessive person, and that might be why I liked it so much. And in fact, I photographed and have on my phone a dozen of his pages because I had to give it back to the library. So I wanted to have them with me. And one of my favorite parts is she looks through, you know, the mix of emotions that obsession will bring to people, which is one reason why it's easy to be obsessive about obsession. So she puts out a questionnaire and she asks all these Judy Garland fans things like, you know, when do you feel closest to Judy? And one of my favorite answers was when I'm defending her against people. And then, but possibly my favorite of all was, does Judy have any characteristics that you share? We're both short with brown hair and we're both very musical people. Come on, isn't that fantastic? We're both short. We are both very musical. So, yeah, in fact, Susie Boyd, one of the reasons why her book is so wonderful, that besides being empathetic and sympathetic and very human, she has a really good sense of humor. So she tells this one funny story, which I'm going to read to you, about being in a cafe. And she says, one of the things on the menu was affogato. "What is it?" I asked. "It's a small cup of espresso poured over a scoop of vanilla ice cream." We pondered that. What does an ordered one? "What does affogato mean?" my friend pressed. The waitress darted back into the kitchen and returned with the dish. I asked the chef. He's Brazilian. He says it means drowned, but I guess you could kind of interpret it and say it means floating. We looked differently at the courageous little dessert after that, presented by its pathologically hopeful waitress. Not drowning, but floating. And in fact, she's...
I like that.
I know, isn't that wonderful? The dessert was not drowning, but floating. It's very irreverent, and it's very funny. And
it's a bit like the cup half full or half empty.
That's right. That's exactly right. And she's got this wonderful story of Judy Garland. She was a drama queen, but she also had a fantastic sense of humor. And there's my favorite anecdote. Oh, it's hard to have a favorite. Anyway, one great anecdote. Judy's in the powder room, as it was called in those days, and she encounters a fan who tells her, "Judy, never forget the rainbow." And Judy replies grandly on her way out of the powder room, "Lady, how could I forget? I've got rainbows coming out of my ass." So that's my first choice. My second choice is Eileen Miles, who has been one of my favorite literary figures. I'm going to say that because not only do I love her, love the writing, but also the actual person behind it, from what I know, but I'll get to know more. Since I read Chelsea Girls, which was an autobiographical novel starting from growing up in a Catholic family in working class part of Boston and then taking off for New York in the 1970s, the Chelsea Hotel, Life as a Poet, and it really just blew me away. It was just so bright and so smart and so cool, like the absolute best sense of the word cool, not
right.
just as a
I'm going to add that one to my reading list.
You
Thank
definitely
you, Karen.
Should. And in terms of cool, I want to tell about this very moving chapter where she is writing a letter to her father, who was an alcoholic who died while she was still at a Catholic girls' school. And she says, well, the death is going to let her be different, and she's going to show them. So that's the boys who are jerks and the girls who think they're better than she is. And she says, speaking of the life she will now lead, "I would be a beatnik. I would make everyone so sad and be so cool," which is exactly what happened. What didn't happen is that she didn't continue using the word she. I'm using she there because at the time of Chelsea Girls, that's what Eileen Miles used. But from being a she, the tomboy she, the she who's just like a boy, then a young woman, dyke she, and then moved to my gender, quote from her, "My gender is not female, my gender is Eileen." And then a couple of years ago, actually began using the gender-neutral term they, the pronoun they. And I'm going to be honest, like Eileen, I want to say it was hard for me at first to learn to use this pronoun. I didn't have a problem with people wanting to use it, but it was hard to become natural for me to use it. For people who identify as gender non-binary, because I was thinking like Rubeau's poem, you know, zero or one, it was one or the other. And so if it was neither, it was a not. And then it was hard for my mind to step from the not to the all. And then I read a wonderful piece in Slate, which tells the story of Ariel Levy asking Eileen Miles about using they. And the reply was, "I'm obsessed with that part in the Bible when Jesus is given the opportunity to cure a person possessed by demons. And Jesus says, 'What is your name?' And the person replies, 'My name is Legion.' And Eileen says, 'Whatever is not normative is many.' And the reporter says, 'The possibilities of gender, in other words, are as vast and manifold as the individuals who claim identities outside the norm need them to be.'" And in fact, Eileen Miles is the ultimate outsider, outsider being a status that has always appealed to me. And I've often felt an outsider, having lived in many foreign countries for most of my life. But also, as her ex-partner said, not just for that, but also, "I've never met someone whose outside and inside were so much the same thing." So I'm going to end now with a wonderful piece from their later novel, Inferno, a poet's novel, and it is about poetry. And it goes like this. "Poetry, and this is why I love it and will until I die, always winds up being the conga line between random chaos and it being the real monster moving up the coast. the norm, pretty much the white norm, though if you agree to its terms, anyone can come. Well, one of anyone. That's what makes it so unsufferable here, this horrible view that the mind's possessed of two stops. Good, which includes everything from safe for kids to the entire grim suburban American maw full of uplifting, meaningful, accessible verse. Then, dirty and crazy. And I would include inaccessible in there as well. Poetry that refuses to give it up on a first reading. We don't have time for that. And we don't have time for anything else, Luisa. So time to say goodbye and see you at the festival.
Yes, enjoy the festival, everyone.
Ka kite anō.
Community X.